Good morning. My name is David Malin, and I'll be your instructor today and tomorrow, along with the whole team. So we have so much excitement in store for you. You are here at 9:15 a.m., and the goal for the next hour or so is to give you a taste of CS50 in person, albeit in humbler settings than Sanders Theater, as you know from film, to also give you a sense of why we do what we do and to try to give you a glimpse behind the scenes of some of the pedagogy, but much more on that later today and tomorrow as well. And mostly going to be an opportunity to get folks excited, maybe get a few volunteers up to the front of the room. Thereafter, we're going to dive into this is CS50 AP, leading a successful CS50 AP classroom, and really giving you a focus on the content and the logistics and the support structure and trying to address as many of those FAQs as possible. Throughout any of these sessions, though, by all means, interject with a hand or a question as needed. At 12 p.m., we'll have lunch right here today. At 2:45, we will dive into a mini section wherein Jason Hirshhorn, longtime teaching fellow heading up our initiative at Yale, is going to give you a sense of what it's like to lead a more intimate environment as we would typically do here in sections. At 3:30 p.m., we have a wonderful campus tour lined up with one of our undergrads who's going to give you an exclusive tour of Widener Library, the very large library that you might have passed this morning. And then after the end of that, we'll adjourn for dinner in Annenberg Hall, which is the beautiful dining hall in which all freshmen eat that's right next to Sanders Theater. And then we'll come back here and do an office hours style walkthrough opportunities and actually get our hands dirty with some of the piece sets and go through the motions of and help you with whatever piece set you happen to be on. But without further ado, much like we begin lecture most every day, allow me to introduce CS50's own Colton Ogden.
Okay. MIDI controller, so it interfaces with a it can interface with any digital audio workstation is the term, but it's basically it sends MIDI signals to a piece of software that then triggers audio clips. Or you can do a lot of different things with it, but in this particular scenario, that's what's being used for.
Novation Launchpad?
Yes. Novation Launchpad.
Okay. Novation.
That. Will be now my 9th year teaching the class, and I want to emphasize that most everything we've introduced into the course over the years has been either an experiment, some of which have failed, which you won't necessarily see today, some of which have succeeded, but also have been specific solutions, we hope, to actual problems. And so while it might be easy to be a little overwhelmed at first at all of the various resources and not to be quite sure what you should point students at or when to point them at those resources, realize that all of this has arisen very organically, and you too should feel free to wade in and not feel as though you have to dive in directly. And as I've been thinking about what sort of governs the sort of philosophy of CS50, because years ago I certainly didn't have a bulleted list of like things I am going to do in this kind of class, but retrospectively I would say that I could distill CS50 into these three characteristics. And the first and foremost was absolutely deliberate. Back in 2007 when I took over the course was to make the course much more accessible. CS50 has been around for some 25 years now on campus, was always well reputed, well before my time, but always had this reputation to beware. And dare say computer science more generally tends still to have that reputation. And so it was not a course for the uninitiated. It was not a course for the less comfortable. And indeed, the semester began with a look at something called assembly language, if familiar, and realized now in 2007 we turned the course on its head deliberately to introduce our students to Scratch. Now, granted, we spent just a week on Scratch, but the goal was to change that initial slope so that we still end with as much rigor as we ever had, but to ease that on-ramp so that ultimately any student who takes this course, whether at the college or at the high school level, can indeed succeed. And it's worth noting, too, along these lines, that the course really hasn't been designed for Harvard students, per se, or Yale students, per se. In fact, since 2007, the course has been available through Harvard's Division of Continuing Education, or Extension School, which is our continuing ed program, for students in high school, for adults in retirement, and everything in between. And through edX, similarly, have we had a hugely broad and open enrollment for students from all walks of life, academically, socioeconomically, and so realize too, irrespective of what your own town might be like, realize that the goal is to make the course broadly accessible to each and every demographic, irrespective of a student's prior background or lack thereof. But culture is kind of a funnier one, since this is something that sort of plays off of the last, which is rigor. I would certainly admit that the course has maybe a playful side to it, and this is manifests itself, as you saw last night perhaps, with a lot of the fun photos and the posters on the wall, the stress balls, the sunglasses, the photo booth, the DJ at the start of lectures, and frankly, this was very much a deliberate sort of decision in so far as I felt we could get away with the sort of playfulness. In fact, when I inherited the course, I absolutely didn't want to make the course all the more accessible at the expense of its content and its rigor and its reputation. And yet we found, I think, this luxury in maintaining, we hope, that rigor and counterbalancing it with this playfulness so that everyone feels not just part of a class, but part of something we hope special, a little collective experience, a shared experience. And that particularly manifests itself, as you may have seen in some of our photos, at events like Puzzle Day and the Hackathon and the fair, all of which will help you stand up if you would like in some form at your own local schools. But that, of course, is premised on the fact that we maintain the course's historical rigor. For students here and through Harvard Extension School and through edX, each of the problem sets in their traditional formats absolutely takes 10, 15, 20, 25 hours a week. Now, granted, we adhere to a 12-week schedule, and the luxury of CS50 AP and the luxury, frankly, of the online CS50X version, the MOOC version through edX, is that students will have some 36 or so weeks at the high school level, or even 52 weeks through edX. And frankly, we are certainly nearing the point in CS50 where technologically and I think pedagogically, it's a superior experience to take the course asynchronously in that way and to have more than just our 12 weeks on campus so that he or she can work at their own his or her own pace in the class so that you can rewind and fast forward and spend an extra week, whereas we don't quite have that same luxury here at the college. So realize, I would dare say, this is an advantage, especially at the AP level, so that you have a more time to play with and can calibrate a little more closely to your own students. So behind all of this is going to be a huge support structure for for you in person, for instance, these couple of days, online, hereafter, each other. This is a photo from last year's largely undergraduate teaching staff. CS50 has, we believe, the largest course support staff on campus with nearly 100 staff members, myself and Colton, the production team, and Jason, and Michael, and Chang, and Jordan, and everyone else that you've met here today, as well as some 80-plus other folks who will be returning to campus in just a few weeks, who largely lead sections, as we call them, and recitations, and generally provide students with a very rich support structure and an apprenticeship model, if you will. In addition to that, you'll see manifest at the end of the semester, hopefully some tokens of pride like this, where at least at our CS50 fair here on campus, we reward everyone at the very end of the semester with this proclamation that they might not want to do it again, but they did nonetheless take CS50 and they indeed succeeded. And in fact, the course itself is not a filtration style class. It's not the course really where students tend to fail. If you fail in CS50, at least here on campus, it's really for lack of trying or lack of engagement or for some particular personal or familial issue. Indeed, the course recognizes, and we'll talk more about this later today, students' starting point. So that what ultimately matters is indeed where students end up relative to themselves in week 12 vis-a-vis week 0, irrespective of every one of their classmates who might have been programming since, say, they were 12 years old. And so that's a very deliberate and time-consuming process to actually calibrate the assessment to individual students, but I do think it makes all of the difference. Now, to get you perhaps excited at the culture that we hope you will brew locally and adopt and adapt in some form at your own school with your own students, I thought I'd play a teaser video that our production team put together this past spring for the so-called pre-frosh, the kids that have been accepted into Harvard College, who were here visiting for a couple of days and wanted to get a sense of Harvard, and we hope CS50 specifically. And so this film aired in Sanders Theater just a few months back. Is CS50, Harvard University's introduction to the intellectual enterprises of computer science and the art of programming.
Dedicated and passionate and committed.
And duck face, David.
At the hackathon. I'm here today with about 4,000 students, and we're going to find out what they're up to, working on their final project.
At this point in the night, we're starting to hit the coffee pretty hard.
Please cheer quickly. There's a lot of money involved.
We are here at the 28th consecutive hour of the CS50 hackathon. Why do you laugh?
Prepared, because you're going to love it.
So, where and why do we begin? So we begin every semester here in so-called week zero, and we focus on what computational thinking is, or more generally, what computer science is, because so many kids come to the college these days still conflating computer science with programming alone. And in fact, the image that many of them have from computer labs back in high school or just growing up is that computer science is in fact programming, when really we try to make the point very early in the term, in this first week, and even with CS50 Puzzle Day, that it's all about problem solving, irrespective of the particular implementation details of the language that you must now need to speak as a tool that one uses in one's, I don't know what we're about to say, but as a tool that one has in one's own toolkit. And so we propose, albeit with some simplification, that computer science is about thinking like a computer, computational thinking. But what does that mean? How do you think like a computer? Well, we ultimately need three ingredients. We need inputs, like some inputs to the problem that we actually care about. We need outputs, which is hopefully the solution to that problem. And then we need a solution, algorithms, or sets of instructions for solving some problems. And these three ingredients together give us solutions to problems and allow us any number of ways to represent or implement these various ideas. And let's start simple. And in fact, let's in week zero here, even though this is presumably familiar to most everyone here, let's imagine what it might be like for a student coming into the class where he or she probably generally knows that computers think in terms of zeros and ones, and they might not have really thought twice about what that could possibly mean. But if you do think about it, if we humans can count 0 through 9 and then higher, but computers can only count 0 to 1, this seems a huge limitation. Moreover, how do you represent the number 2, let alone 3 or higher, in just zeros and ones? And so what we very deliberately do at the beginning of the semester, even though it's sort of hints of a bit of math, which certainly can scare a few kids very early on, what we try to do is give them a mental model that they already have and then transition them to a new world, which is, in this case, binary. And so in the world of computers, of course, we might have just 0 and 1 at our disposal. But of course, in our human world, we're familiar with 0 through 9. But it turns out that thinking like a computer is quite like thinking like a human. In fact, it's arguably a bit simpler. So I might ask the question in week 0, so here is a number. And what number is this? 123. Excellent. So 123. But why? Right? It's probably been a long time since any of us thought about why this set of symbols, 1 and then the curvy 2 and then the extra curvy 3, represents semantically this notion of 123, this actual value. But if you're like me back in grade school, you probably were taught to represent numbers by way of these columns or placeholders. And now perhaps there's already a light bulb, no pun intended, going off in students' heads where, oh, right, so it's been a while since I cared to think about this. But this is surely the ones place, the tens place, and the hundreds place. So now let's just give them a definition and a formalization of this mental model they already have. This means, of course, that 100 times 1 is going to give you something, plus 10 times 2, plus 1 times 3. And so now, why do the three symbols, 1, 2, 3, represent the number we know as 123? Well, it's 100 plus 20 plus 3, which of course is 123. Now at this point, hopefully no one is particularly lost because they've had this sort of upbringing and it's sort of natural, even if it hasn't been formalized like this ever, or at least in quite some time. But if you stipulate now that, okay, I get that, let's now transition, frankly, to a simpler world of computers and actually introduce students to this notion of zeros and ones. So it turns out that with computers, they, of course, just use different columns or different places. Instead of powers of 10, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, and so forth, we instead have powers of 2. So 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, and so forth. But the idea is exactly the same. In fact, at this point in the story, what does this pattern of 0, 0, 0 probably represent in our human world? Well, it's just 0. And the math is, of course, exactly the same. 4 times 0 plus 2 times 0 plus 1 times 0 is, of course, 0. So even if for the non-computer students in the classroom, well, how might we represent the number 1? Well, we, of course, just need to flip one of those values over to 1 and ultimately have some way of representing other patterns. And at this point, too, this has evolved over time. This is sort of version 1 of our binary bulb, so to speak, whereby literally the night before, in fall 2013, I realized, oh, it'd be kind of nice, instead of just showing, you know, PowerPoint slides up on the screen with digital text, why don't I actually grab something that has a physical switch? And I went to Target, and I think for $4.99 each, got a light bulb and a desk lamp, and it actually turned into this fabulous giveaway at the end. If for some reason, everyone wanted a desk lamp that year. But we can use this to represent exactly the same idea. So of course, if we have the ones column here, the twos column here, the fours column here, this of course is the number we humans know as 0. And this of course would now be 1. This of course would now be 2. Okay, 3, right? I've made a mistake already, but that's right. So if I have 2 times 1, that's 2 plus 1 times, okay, so 3. But the fix here is very simple. So there's going to be kind of this toggling of lights on and off, much like carrying the 1 in our decimal world, with which humans might be familiar. And now to represent the number 3, we do deliberately turn this on. Now we go ahead and turn on the number 4. Now we go ahead and turn on the number 5. I saw a hand go this way. And now it's actually really hard to do this backwards. I'm really looking for the answer. Now the number 6. and then the number 7. Now, of course, you don't need to find light bulbs and extension cords. And frankly, we just barely, thanks to Doug, found these since we only use them once in a while. Do 3 volunteers in the room have cell phones that have flashlights? Could we get 3 volunteers who are comfy being on camera for just a moment? Who has a flashlight and knows how to use the flashlight in their phone? Come on up, please. And come on up, please. And one more, come on up from the back. All right, we have Marcus. Come on up. And if you want to line up right under one of your place values. And we have Josh and Minda. So pick a number. All right, so hardest part here must be finding the menu, but leave it off initially. All right. That doesn't count. Okay, so here we have, of course, the number 0. All right, and now a challenge from the audience. Someone give us a number that these kind folks might represent. Yes?
8.
8! Give me 8. And, very clever. Okay, so that's great. There's always that student, too, so get ready for it. Okay, and so let's a softball. Let's give them at least 1 or 2 others here as a challenge, and scoot back under your numbers if you could. We just have just 3 zeros and ones, and so-called bits. And in fact, the etymology of bits is just binary digits, bi meaning 2, binary meaning a system of 2 values. So bits has just all this time been binary digits. So here we have 3 bits. Who want to represent what value next?
6,
I heard first. No pressure. Correct? Excellent. All right, one more number. 3. Wow, 3 from 2 people. 3. Excellent. All right, and a big round of applause for our spontaneous volunteers. Come on. Thank you so much. So this is actually demonstrative of something we very deliberately do in CS50. That, dare say, took longer than it might have for me to zoom through an idea like this or have a worksheet that students work on. And frankly, I do concede that sometimes the visuals, especially when you have buggy humans, which we didn't have this time, but humans who might make mistakes, you know, could be easy for some students, especially those less comfortable, to get a little lost in the narrative if the answer isn't immediately given to them. But the reality is my hope, and in fact our experience in CS50, it's that precisely these visuals, these memorable moments, are what stick with students far more effectively than boring text on the screen. And so for me, thematically, and if you watch CS50's lectures online from 2007 onward, really lectures have increasingly become focused on less content per unit of time, but as many visuals as we can conjure. And thankfully, I occasionally think of something new, or more often a colleague proposes something, or I see another educator teaching some topic in some way, and we somehow adapt or adopt that idea into the class. And there's so many opportunities, especially in the world in which we play, C in particular, having pointers and memory management. I mean, there's literally so many opportunities for people and humans to be pointing. And so I would encourage you to embrace this kind of pedagogy where you feel it's appropriate for exactly that reason of those memorable moments. And in fact, surely all of you in this room knew most all of that and could surely teach it yourselves, but hopefully now you've seen at least someone else kind of make a goof of him or herself so that this idea perhaps can be adopted or adapted in some form in classrooms as well. So now let's stipulate we have a way of representing information. We know how to represent zeros and ones. For time's sake, let's assume that we can take zeros and ones and represent letters too. And in fact, as you know, spoiler for next class, is going to be that we just choose arbitrary numbers that will represent letters. Turns out humans have decided the number 65 represents the capital letter A, and 97 happens to represent lowercase a. Not interesting details to memorize for you or for students, but let's now assume that if we can go from numbers to letters, we can probably go to graphics and sounds and movies, but it's going to take more time than we have now for today. But for now, we at least have a way of representing basic information. So now let's do something with it to produce outputs. So an algorithm is a set of instructions for solving some problem. And now I'm already feeling the pressure of time, whereby decreasingly do Harvard students know what this thing is. And I think you're at even more of a disadvantage since they're a few years younger still. But this is a wonderful prop with which to talk about algorithms and problem solving here too, because much like we hope the counting, the 123, students already have a sort of intuition about how to go about finding someone in this phone book or the digital equivalent where things are similarly sorted from A to Z. You don't necessarily start at the top looking, you jump roughly to where you want to be. But what is that intuition? So here's a problem to be solved. It's got like 1,000 pages. On these pages, and you might have to define this these days, there are lots of human names and lots of human telephone numbers, and what's key is those names, to be clear, they're alphabetical, they're sorted, they're ordered from A to Z. That's important, because if it's random, this problem's going to take a while to solve. So in this phone book now, I could very, if I'm looking for a friend like Mike Smith, I could certainly open the front of the book and just start looking. Is Mike on this page, this page, this page? And I'm in the A section right now. I'm going to get to the B section. So I might ask the question here in class, is this correct? I see a lot of yeses, but you'll likely get, as we do, you know, a few no's. Like, you're an idiot. Like, why would you start at the beginning? But that's good intuition, but now we need to sort of distinguish correctness from efficiency. And we can do this even in the very first class. So this is correct, right? If Mike Smith is in here, I will find him, if slowly. But it's surely not the fastest way. Even in grade school, I learned not to count by ones, but I can do twosies, like 2, 4, 6, 8. So is this more efficient? Is this faster? So absolutely, it's more efficient. Is it correct?
Eventually get there,
but someone want to play the naysayer? Yeah, so what if I skip a page? So there's this corner case, so to speak. 998 times out of 1,000, it might be correct, but if I get Mike Smith in between two pages, I might indeed make a mistake and conclude he's not there, because I reached the T section. Mike Smith is, of course, in the S section, but it's just because I went too fast. I got a little careless. But what's the fix here? What might you do intuitively if you've gone a little too far in a phone book like this? Yeah, so you just double back, not all the way to the beginning, hopefully. So we have to handle that conditionally, we'll say. We need to make a decision at some point. There's a fork in the road. Do I keep going right or do I double back? We'll have to revisit that issue. But of course, none of us are going to solve this problem this way. What would any adult-age human these days do with a device like this?
Throw it away.
Nice. We have not gotten that one before. And other folks, if you really do need Mike's number, binary search, and you might get students like this already chiming in with the answer. We don't want to go there just yet. So binary search, we'll come back to that term, but what, how did you propose?
You try to estimate where the letter in the alphabet is.
Yeah, so Mike Smith,
you know, try to get there.
I don't quite know where the S's are, but you know, my gut tells me I'm just going to go roughly the middle. I'll just kind of split it, it feels comfortable here, and I look down, I'm in the M section. Of course, this is too soon. Mike is presumably to the right, and so here's an opportunity, though an increasingly expensive opportunity, because these things are hard to find, where we can figuratively, but also, actually, that's a good one. literally, tear the problem in half, do something dramatic, like throw it at someone in the class, and it's proving, frankly, they're curious souvenirs over time. But now, what's interesting about this problem is that it's the same problem. The book is the same fundamental problem, it just has half as many pages. So what's my algorithm, or next step, going to be? Yeah, roughly split it again, and now I went a little too far, the T section, but here too, the visual is the opportunity at hand, and this is why we desperately encourage people to give us phone books. You can tear the problem in half again, or use the more familiar jargon, divide and conquer, with which kids at any age might be already familiar. So now we have a problem that was 1,000 pages, then 500, then 250, then 125, and you can kind of feel where this is going. We keep dividing and conquering, and dividing and conquering, until hopefully we're left with just one phone page, and if Mike is in this phone book and on this page, I can now give him a call. And if he's not, then I conclude that he was not, in fact, in this phone book. So that's all fine and good, but why spend 5 minutes talking about something that students intuitively probably had that answer right out of the gate? And in fact, this is one of the things I've sort of learned the hard way over time. There's always going to be the student who yells out binary search or jumps to sort of the spoiler of the story. And so I think it's important, too, to sometimes control the story so that I, for instance, proposed, I'm just going to do linear search, right? I wanted the story to go in the direction I intended, even though it doesn't always go according to plan. But the opportunity now is to try to formalize this, right? That felt like the right solution, feels correct, surely feels more efficient, because I found them in just a few tears, not 1,000. But what can we do to sort of give students now an appreciation that this really looks and feels better? So here's a chart. Might look scary at first glance, but there's deliberately no numbers on it. There's no units of measure because it's the ideas that matter. On the x-axis, or the horizontal line, we have size of the problem. That could mean anything, but in this case, it means like number of pages in the phone book. How big is the problem? The y, or vertical axis, is how much time does it take to solve this problem? So higher up means more time, lower down means less time. So pretty intuitive ideas, irrespective of numbers. And now we have this red line with n, which is a bit curious at this point. But at this point, I might say computer scientists, anytime they need a go-to placeholder, a variable, so to speak, we just call it n for number. So this line means that with that first algorithm, looking one page at a time, every additional page that gets added to the phone book might take me one more unit of time. And if students are already familiar with slope, B over A at this point, it's just the slope is essentially one. One more page, one more turn of the page, potentially. And to make this more clear, what I might propose to students, suppose that this thing called a phone company, Verizon, doubles the number of pages in the phone book next year. Well, that just means jump out to here, but then correspondingly jump up to there, and that's why we have this straight line. There's a one-to-one relationship. So what's the line going to look like for the twosies approach, which was not quite correct out of the gate, but was surely more efficient? Yeah, so I'm seeing a hand suggest this. It's the same shape, but it's lower, which suggests that for any given number of pages in the phone book, whereas the first algorithm, and I can't quite point from this height, might be at the very top of that red line, for the faster algorithm, where I'm going twice as fast, I'm instead only going to need this much time here in yellow. But that's all fine and good, but it kind of looks the same, right? I could do it by threes or fours, and the line would keep getting better and better. But that's not really a clever solution to the problem. And in fact, Google and Facebook, who have billions of pieces of data, I deliberately sort of tie in these real-world examples very early on. We don't have to talk about what's in the database, but surely there's a lot of stuff in it these days. This doesn't feel like the best solution, to just search through things left to right. Well, let's do what we did intuitively. The divide and conquer, and though this might look a bit scary at the first glance, log of n is just how a computer scientist describes a problem whose efficiency looks like this, where it's not straight, it's definitely curved, it doesn't become straight, though it kind of looks like it's flattening out. And even though this intuitively might not be obvious to most students at first glance, let's consider the Verizon example again. Suppose Verizon next year takes their 1,000-page phone book, maybe merges a couple of adjacent towns in the same book, and doubles the pages to 2,000. How many more steps is my third and final algorithm going to take next year when the phone book is twice as big?
One more step.
Just one more step. So if you start here this year, jump out here next year, you're only going up one additional step. If you quadruple, you're only going up two additional steps. And so this is why this curve grows ever so more slowly, because your problem is taking much bigger bites. Your algorithm is taking much bigger bites out of the problem than your onesies or your twosies approach step by step. Now, conversely, let's now try to blow some mind. Or rather, relatedly, let's try to blow some mind. So I'm talking about 1,000 pages, 2,000 pages. That's not such a big deal these days. Suppose that a phone book, crazy phone book, had like, I don't know, 4 billion pieces of paper in it, 4 billion pages. How many steps? How many times am I going to have to divide that phone book to find Mike Smith if Verizon gives me a 4 billion page phone book? It's got to be a lot. Hundreds? Thousands? A few million? Clearly a leading question. We got Price is Right opportunity here. Anyone want to hazard a guess? 32, yeah, give or take rounding-wise, depending on exactly how precise my 4 billion is. Yeah, and we could do the math if we really wanted to. And this probably isn't, this might be a good sort of convincing here or a good at-home exercise, but you go from 4 billion to 2 billion to 1 billion to 500 million to 250 million. All right, I'm kind of losing track, but if I did this on paper, I would only write down some 32, maybe 31, depending on exactly the number I pick. Total page tears. And that's because this algorithm is taking such large bites out of it every time. It's not taking one or two pages, it's taking half of the problem again and again. Now let's move on to another example still. So this was an example of using just one CPU or one computer brain. Can we solve problems more efficiently by leveraging multiple CPUs? Do something called that computer scientists call parallel processing, which means do lots of stuff at the same time instead of one thing at a time. Now, if I were to do one thing at a time and I wanted to take attendance today, I might go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. But let's improve this. What's the next version of that algorithm? Yeah, so 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 definitely sounds and feels faster, but come on, we've sort of gone down this road before. If you could humor me for just a moment and have everyone stand up and take on the number 1. Can you count people for real? Everyone stand up. So at this point in the story, everyone is the number 1. Step 2 of this algorithm that we're all going to do in parallel is this. Pair off with someone standing, add your numbers together, and then just one of you should sit down. Just the adults, just the teachers.
I've done it.
All right.
I'd love to. I want to stand up. Let me stand up.
So at this point in the story, it seems like it took a lot of convincing to get people to sit down. So at this point in the story, roughly half of the room should be sitting, because every pair had one person sit, and everyone standing has what number in mind?
Two.
Except maybe for some one lone person if we have an odd number of people. Three. That's fine. We'll go with this. So I have one more step for you. If you could finish executing this algorithm as follows. One of you should sit down. The other should go back to step two. So one of you has sat down, so the one still standing should go back to step two.
What's that? Doug says 45.
Can you count again? Quickly. Just the folks at the table. Okay. It's happening again. So we have almost there. I'm going to have to update my chart in a minute if we don't speed this one up. So we have three. That's all right. I'll interject at this point. It's proving too hard for everyone to pair off. So we have a few people still standing. Two or three? Okay, so we have one person standing. And what number is you?
12.
So you are 12, and then you are?
15,
which gives us 27, which is at least 8 people fewer than are actually here. But that's good. That's good. We'll embrace it. Thank you. That's our first example of a bug, if you will, a program that's somehow flawed. But let's consider how this should have gone. Now, as an aside, I've learned the hard way, especially when in the fall these days we have some 800 students staring me down trying to see how well I can do arithmetic. This is a nice calculator, which I suggest bringing to the first class if you do have some 30 or 40 students in front of you and there's a few lonesome folks who now need to toss their numbers at you. If you're not super fast at arithmetic as I'm not, having a calculator handy will save some awkwardness there. So now what should have happened here? So on each iteration of these steps, half of the folks in the room, in theory, sat down. So we kept dividing the problem in half and half and half until in theory we would have had just one person, but I intervened and just merged those last two people, which is fine. You don't want something like that to go on for too long. So what should that algorithm have felt like, though? Well, in my first approach, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the analog there, of course, is the red line. It's a one-to-one relationship. Then I had my twosies approach, which definitely was faster and therefore takes less time. But in theory, how should your algorithm have worked? Well, again, we started with n people, or 30-some-odd people, and then half of the folks sat down. Half of the folks sat down. Half of the folks sat down until, in theory, we had just one person. And so the efficiency of your algorithm, or the visual shape of it, if you will, is exactly the same as our phone book example. Now, of course, there's some bugginess here that we should work through, perhaps, but at the end of the day, by embracing this extra resource, more brains, or more computer brains, or more CPUs, if you will, central processing units, can we solve a problem much more effectively than a single CPU, could have as well. And so this is a fun example, and frankly, it's a lot more fun when it does become buggy. If it all works out perfectly, everyone doesn't quite appreciate, you know, what the point of it all was. In fact, it's important too to note that with the pseudocode here, as I'll soon introduce, it's arguable, and as a student might note, well, wait a minute, David's algorithm was really like one step repeated. Just go back to step one. Count, 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 count. When here I'm kind of cheating. I gave you three things to do again and again and again. But that's okay, because recall from our chart, we just said size of the problem, or rather, and the time to solve it. Fairly general, independent of units of measure. So I guess one of my acts might be this and this And this one of yours had a bit of a loop to it, but if you consider the process of standing up, pairing, and adding as one operation, as is completely reasonable, as we'll see, the same idea can apply. And this allows us to not get into asymptotic notation or fancier stuff that we'll surely get to a few weeks later in the semester. So now, let's try to formalize this. Thus far, we've done everything fairly verbally and very intuitively, dare say, but now we kind of have to rein ourselves in because, as we'll soon see, computers are not all that bright. They can only do literally what we tell them to do. So how do we tell a computer to do something? Well, most students would probably be familiar with the general idea of programming, even if they've never seen it. So let's introduce a computer program using English, or something that would be more fancily called pseudocode. It's not code, computer code, it's pseudocode. It's sort of like code, but it's kind of arbitrary English-like syntax. So what do we have here? We have on line one just a statement. I'm going to start calling an action, a verb, a statement. So pick up phone book, and that's what I did initially to find Mike Smith. Step two, open to middle phone book. That too would be a statement. And how that's implemented could take any number of steps, but we can choose to define this algorithm at any level of detail, and we're going to keep it up here for now. Step three, look at names, another statement, if you will. Step four, if Smith is among names. Now this kind of sounds different. And what, those of you who are familiar with programming, what would this be called here? So a conditional, or a branch, a so-called fork in the road. Why? Well, just even if you have no familiarity with programming, it's a decision point, right? If Mike Smith is among the names, I want to do one thing. I want to look at his number and call him. If he's not, I need to decide, do I go left or do I go right? So we have this three-way fork in the road, and that's going to decide whether I do step 5 or step 7 and 8, or steps 10 and 11, or even step 13. And note, too, the indentation here. This, too, is just human convention. Computers don't need us to necessarily indent our lines, our sentences like this. But the fact that these lines are indented, this one's indented, this one's indented, I would note to students that this is just a common convention in programming to associate certain actions with a previous decision. And the indentation, of course, means that this goes with this, and so on. So we have now some pseudocode, if you will, that could be implemented in any number of other ways. And I should note that we're sort of taking an old school approach here of using what in yesteryear was the go-to statement in certain languages. And even C has this, even though we don't use it in class. But this is arguably, this would be, I would say, among the more intuitive ways to define Mike Smith's algorithm without certainly going into a recursive algorithm or anything fancier at this point in time. We just want to transition now to a formalization of code. Now, why? Well, at the risk of throwing many songs and dances at folks here. We don't necessarily always do all of these within the same hour. We need three other volunteers. Thank you. Three other volunteers. Come on up. You just have to be comfy on camera and come on up. And with an activity you're about to learn. One more person. Come on up. All right. So we have three chairs here. And could we bring up a fourth? Come on up. All right. And do you want to grab a fourth for yourself, Chang? All right, come on up. And Chang, why don't we put you at this end, if you can. And what are your names again?
Marlon.
Marlon and?
Miriam.
Miriam.
Megan.
And Megan and?
Chang.
Chang, nice to meet you. Okay, so what we have here is some forethought. You're going to have to share here, if that's okay. But we have a loaf of bread, as canonical as possible, being Wonder Bread here. We have some supplies in back here, including a peanut butter for each of you. And we have some knives for each of you, courtesy of the very dining hall you will see later today. And then we have three jellies and one corner case, it would seem. And Chang, if you don't mind just supervising here, what we don't have, because David forgot to grab them, are plates today. So we do have some paper towel. Do we have plates in back? Oh, perfect. Perfect save. I left them in back earlier. All right. So this is going to be an opportunity. And this has certainly taken its form in any number of computer science classes, but for at least me, This was inspired by my fifth grade homeroom teacher who used exactly this example to teach us how to follow, or really how not to follow, directions. Indeed, the goal at hand as it is today is to make us a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but taking directives from the audience here, and let's see if now we can handle, solve a few problems at once. The most important of which is to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. The second of which, though, is going to be as precise as possible and to help me formalize this using English-like syntax in the form of pseudocode that I'll keep track of up here on the board. So I'm going to go ahead and just pull up a sketch pad here. And let's get rid of this. All right. So with some audience participation, could someone propose step one of how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Open the bread. Execute. It's opened. Yeah, this is great. We had three different, very different approaches. Let's see if we can't learn as we go here. Step two.
Put a slice on the plate.
Put a slice on the plate.
Of bread.
Of bread on the plate. All right, someone want to give us step three?
Take out your knife.
Take out your knife.
Unscrew the top of the peanut butter jar.
Unscrew top of peanut butter jar. With your hand and insert knife. Into the jar. That was the sound of us missing a step. Step five. Let's go over here. It's a protective cover, yeah. So how do we want to handle that? Remove protective cover with knife. Not bad. All right, step six. I heard something else first. Take out. I don't know, a blob of peanut butter
with the knife.
How about approximately a tablespoon?
Approximately one tablespoon. And then step seven, put on bread. Put the peanut butter on the bread.
Spread
with knife. On bread. Step eight. Pick it up and no. Step eight. Open, we're not learning already. Open the jelly. How? With hand.
By unscrewing the lid.
And remove protective cover. Good.
With hands, remove second piece of bread.
From the loaf,
and lay on the plate.
Step 12. What's that? Step 12.
Lay on the plate.
Okay, next to the piece of bread. Lay second piece of bread on the plate next to the piece of bread. Don't put your face in the peanut butter. Step 13.
Use the knife to remove jelly. One tablespoon.
And put the jelly
and spread the jelly on the second, thank you, piece of bread. And spread on second piece of bread. Almost there.
Slap them together.
Gently place second piece of bread. Face down. The orientation is important. Good. All right, a big round of applause for our volunteers here. All right, lunch is now served. So now, a quick word from someone who couldn't be here today. CS50's own Zamyla Chan has been an undergraduate at the college, our walkthrough leader for quite some years. She's now a PhD student here. Unfortunately, she's away today at a conference presenting one of her research papers, but she texted me a hello video that she'd like us to share with you here.
Good morning, this is Myla saying hi from sunny California. I'm so sorry that I can't join you all for the CS50 AP Bootcamp. I'm at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory presenting on my research. But I'm so glad that all of you took the time out to attend this bootcamp. I'm so excited about this endeavor. I think that it's really amazing and I'm really excited to see how this goes from next school year to beyond. So I hope that you have a great time learning about CS50, and sharing your high schools and your communities with us, and most importantly, meeting the other educators and connecting with people who are just as passionate about sharing computer science. So I'd love to hear how everything is going. Do drop me a line if you have the chance on Twitter. My name is Zamyla, and this is CS50 AP.
In just a moment, we're going to take a break, followed by more content, more logistics, more information, and more questions. But first, a film in which Zamyla herself starred that was played for, similarly, the Visiting Prefrosh this past spring, that paints the picture, thanks to CS50's production team, of a CS50 student on her way to CS50's lecture for the very first time. I give you, with our friends in one of the a cappella groups on campus, the Veritones, Feeling Good.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on a tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Oh, for me. It's a new day, it's a new life. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. I feel so good.